six, seven, eight, nine, 10.
Okay. First thing I was curious about is the reaction from the business community when Maynard Jackson became mayor.
I would say it was somewhere between serious concern and panic. Maynard Jackson, of course, being the first black mayor. Now, let me step back 1 minute just to put myself in perspective, because probably of a number of reasons why I'm here and have been here for 15 years, that was the main reason. I, you know, my background is I was involved as a chief administrative officer under Allen and his administration. I was a newspaper reporter, even going back, covered City Hall under the Hartsfield days. And then I came through, it was Sam Massell's chief administrative officer for the first year and a half or so. Mm-hmm. And so I've been involved through that, working on both sides. I was the, for a while, the only person that, well, I was the communicator between Maynard Jackson and Massell at City Hall when they wouldn't speak to each other. And Massell was mayor and Jackson was president of City Council. And I was, well, I guess it's still Aldermanic Board then, before it changed, but anyway, and my title then was not just chief administrative officer, it was a weird title called chief administrative officer of the mayor and board of aldermen. So technically I worked for both, and I was the middleman and literally the whipping boy in that process. I do recall at one point, you know, I told Maynard, because Maynard was going to run for mayor, and he was cutting Massell down. Mm-hmm. Massell saw what was happening, and so he was going to be mayor, not let Maynard be mayor. And I remember a real discussion I had with Maynard. I finally told Maynard, I said, Maynard, now I'm in a hell of a position. I said, but now I've got to tell you, so you and I will understand where we come from. I can't serve two masters. And the nature of this position, where I have to serve the mayor. Now, if you were the mayor, I'd salute you. You ain't the mayor. Mm-hmm. Massell is the mayor. I have to salute myself, and I want you to know that. And he, in fairness to him, he said, I understand your dilemma, and I'll try not to put you in the middle any more than I have to.
I didn't realize they didn't get along. I guess it was a political competition.
It was a political situation that was, yeah. And so, at any rate, so I was there, and then I left there to go set up the Atlanta Regional Commission as its first executive director, and I did that and was fat, numb, and happy over there, at the best public administrative organization in America, I think, really. And then I was approached by the business community to come down here and take over this organization. And I delayed on it. I just sort of sloughed it off for months. I'm doing, you know, I've got this thing going. I got the best job in public administration in America. Paid more money than anybody in the South at that point. And got the best staff. I had 135 staff people with mostly PhDs or master's degrees in criminal justice, in city planning, public administration. I said, you know, and I've weathered the storm, did the Chattahoochee River study, very controversial, did a couple of them, did Russell's transportation planning away from Tom Morgan and the state on the regional basis, big fact. And I said, so, you know, I'm riding high. So why would I do this? And they kept asking, Dan, while they didn't necessarily write it out or say it just these words, the message just kept coming through. Listen, things are changing in the city. We know that. No longer can a handful of business leaders that are closely aligned through families, through civic ties, Massell, Ivan Allen, Woodruff, Mills Lane, James Robinson, and so forth. No longer can we gather out at the Piedmont Driving Club, you know, on Saturday afternoon and make the decisions, call the mayor, say, listen, this is a good idea, and sort of get them moving. They recognize that you had all these movements going on in the city, in the country, in the environment. Citizen participation, a lot of it coming out of the war on poverty and that whole maximum feasible participation philosophy and process. Neighborhood, the neighborhood movement, anti-highway movement, women's liberation, historic preservation, environmental impact, EEO, all those things, which was enough to make any self-respecting white businessman quake in his boots, you know. So they recognized those were changing, and they, and at the same time, that old line group was getting old, dying off, retiring, and as the city was expanding, you had all these new business places showing up that needed to get involved in the process of decision making. You had the new developers like the Cousins and the Portons and the Carters coming on the scene. And then these, as the most of the regional firms of the national offices being located, you had some pretty significant business people that says, we want in. So that they recognized there had to be some change.
Mm-hmm.
But the major change was they recognized we were going to have a black mayor come 1974 January, and that there would be black political power, and there had to be a whole new way to communicate with City Hall and with the political sector, the control of the public sector. And so that was the reason they kept coming, said, Dan, you know, your background, you've worked in both camps, main on the public side, you worked with the black leadership from the worked at the grassroots of the poverty program as the first employee of the Law on Poverty here. Really organized a lot of it under Tony.
You had the connections.
Huh?
You had the connections with the black community.
Yeah, I was acceptable and the black community trusted me. I was also, because of the Atlanta Regional Commission, I was hired acceptable to the county commissioners and the mayors out in the suburbs. And I had the basic good relationship with the press and everybody else. So. And I had both the academic credentials and the management experience as a public administrator. So they said, they said, well, you've got to do this. And so they kept coming back, and finally I succumbed. And I'm glad I did, frankly, because it's more to my whole makeup and personality and style than the Atlanta Regional Commission. I'm too, I'm impatient. I have six things moving now, rather than planning for the year 2010, which is important, which Harry West, my successor, and I won't call my protege, but certainly I got him over there and left him over there. That's Harry's style, great, he's done a great job. Me, I have to.
Yeah, I understand.
See things. So that's what happened, and I came in as the liaison, the middleman, and recognized the great fear. I'm a great fear that Maynard Jackson is the first black mayor. I mean, what, you know, he's coming in with a social agenda, things are changed. So there was a great sense of apprehension, fear, and in some cases bordering on panic.
What was the sense that he was anti-white? Was it this general fear? Was there any basis to business leaders' charge that he was anti-white?
There was a perception that he was anti-white. And I'm sure in your research in the headlines in the newspapers, you probably were thinking about the big headline that came out one day that created, got me marched on by some of my friends like Julian Barr and so forth, where CEP had released this report that one of the things said the mayor was perceived to be anti-white, the Rocky letter. Are you familiar with that?
No, I was over here.
Okay, I'm going to give you, I just been moving, I ran across copies of that Rocky letter.
Okay.
What happened, Harold Brocky was the chairman, he was chairman of Riches, he was the guy that hired me here. We did a survey because of the very thing you're talking about, the attitudes, impressions, concerns. So we did a quick survey analysis out there of the chief concerns among business. And one of the things in there was the perception, the new mayor is perceived to be anti-white. Well, I had concerns about that because I knew that could cause a lot of racial problems. So I the night before we delivered that to Maynard Jackson, I sat on a program with Maynard Jackson, Leadership Atlanta, and I told Maynard, I got problems. We got this report that we think we want to share with you because we want to be open. But we don't want to be, you know, what do we do? This is the language, shall we take it out? He said, don't take it out, Dan. It would not be honest to take it out. I said, well, it wouldn't be honest, but I don't want to, you know, everybody knee jerk. He said, give it to me. Don't take anything out. So, I went over to Harold Brocky the next morning. We're going over to deliver it to the mayor. I said, now, Mr. Brocky, this could create some problems. I talked to Maynard, and I don't see it's going to create any problems. I said, well, I've talked to him, so we're going to get, but knowing how things work, it's probably going to cause some problems. We went over, had a good meeting with Maynard, delivered it to him, and left. Hell, it wasn't 20 minutes after I got back before I had a call from the newspaper, all the time. Dan, what is this Sprocky letter of the mayor, some of the mayor's staff people have gotten upset about that line in there? and told Raleigh, who was a city hall reporter. He called Brocky. Brocky said, "What are you talking about? There was double headlines across the Blue Street front page. Businessmen expressed grave fears to mayor, and it you can't believe what it caused the controversy around here. And so,
but it was felt.
It was felt, and it was it still felt. It's still felt. And Maynard and I talk about this to this day. He's on my board here, and we're friends. But we still talk. That's still a concern.
Was it because of his efforts to force the banks into an affirmative action?
That was part of it. Maynard came in, and really, I never really felt that Maynard was anti-white. I really didn't. I don't now. But he came in. He had to come in. The first black mayor, if it had been Andy Young, been anybody, they would have had to come in with a different type of agenda, social agenda. And while we had made great strides over there, and I brought the first blacks in as department heads and things, there were still, that wasn't the main agenda. So this had to be a agenda. I remember when Larry Gellerstadt, who was my chairman in 74, when Maynard came in, and we made our first courtesy call on Maynard right after he was elected. He took office, and Gellerstadt was like my chair. Larry and I went over and sat down and said, "Okay, Mr. Mayor, you're mayor. Gellerstadt's the new chairman. Sweat's the honcho here. We're anxious to work with you in the administration." The first thing Maynard said, I realize that CAP is the most important organization in the city, you know, and but he said, "I can't work with you." So, beg your pardon. He said, "Well, I can't work with you unless you change your makeup of the organization. You got to put on your board the head of the National Organization of Women and head of the NAACP." And I said, "Wait a minute, Mayor. We ain't a democratic organization. We're not representative. We don't purport to be. What you see is what you get. And we are not going to change our organization. You got to be the CEO of the business." I said, "We've got black CEOs, so we're not racist. We've got, I think we had one or two women on there. I think Ann Cox Chambers and a couple."
Did Jesse Hill from the Russell was on there at the time?
Yeah. I said, "We're not sexist. Even I said, yeah, we look sexist because we don't have many women, but women are eligible. Elitist. We might be elitist because of having a requirement of CEO, but we're not representative." And so we're not going to do it. Of course, then Maynard would keep talking. "Well, we got to bring other people to the table." Every time we'd try to talk with Maynard, we'd need to sit down and have a discussion with him. And initially, he'd take a position, "Well, I can't discuss that without other people at the table." I said, "Well, Maynard, you ain't going to get any decisions made. I mean, you could bring us to the table, you could bring others, and there are times when you can coalesce and bring, but you can't just force us to come to the table and sit down on equal terms with this self-styled head of the XYZ Neighborhood Association." I said, "That ain't the way it works, and it will not work that way." Well, then he took the position, "Well, I'm going to take the money out of the bank. I can't talk to bankers unless they've got blacks and women on the board."
He was pushing for affirmative action.
He was pushing for affirmative action. Right. And I had no problem, and I still don't have a problem with affirmative action. I think his joint venture thing turned out to be the best thing he did, although it created a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So he was heavy-handed. He was a young, big, black lawyer, argumentative. You had to argue with him every step of the way. That was his nature. He'd been white. His background and fame would have been the same thing.
You think so?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He sort of says that during the time when he was pushing the banks for affirmative action and began threatening to pull money out of the banks, if I remember, too, that some of his white friends stayed with him. He mentioned particularly Paul Austin. But he said most of his other white friends in the business leadership community cut and ran, and he was very disappointed. Now, what was the role of Paul Austin here, and who, you know?
Well, I'm not sure I can, of course, Paul was chairman of Coke, and Paul was involved in Action for Women. Paul, was one of the great leaders and had a lot of influence. But in that particular context, I'm not sure I can chair.
Okay. Let me mention something that Ivan Allen said. There was this meeting, I think, at Symphony Hall that a lot of business leaders attended, that Jackson attended also. And Allen made a comment there to the business leaders in 1974 that some of us have gotten too concerned with wanting the city government to fail because it's black. To me, that statement. Was that a feeling?
I suspect that it was a. I suspect among the committed people who loved Atlanta so much, and loved out of the crowd, that was not the feeling. They wouldn't want the city on the field with any crowd. I suspect that there were a lot of whites that really wanted to see that happen, but in my experience, I never heard any legitimate business executive say, I hope son of a bitch falls on his face over there because, you know, get this black ass out of here, you know, nothing like that. I never heard that.
Well, that seemed to be, you know, Alan's perception, and the mayor said something about the fact that it was a sort of a philosophy of let the black administration fall apart and the whites can come back in and clean it up.
I really don't. I never felt that, and because I guess of where I was in my position, because we sort of laugh about it now. We talk about how it would be, you know, if he should be mayor again. I'm not supporting him at this point, but that we could work and use the energy that he and I had to use at that point because he was first black mayor and I had the role I had. If we could use the energy we used up, spark together to do things, what we can accomplish for the city, I think we agree. So I didn't have that feeling, but I was still working with the city to get things done, even though we fought on the way we went about doing it.
Yeah.
And where I was is every time the mayor would do something the business community didn't like, which was almost every day, you know, man, they would call sweat, you go there and get that song, but it's mayor in line. Every time somebody came out the business side, he would call me, well, you better get your boys in line. I remember one morning, it was an editorial, an article in the newspaper about this whole relationship early on, that Maynard had no communication with the business community, et cetera. And he was quoted in there saying, that's not true. So I talked to Dan Sweat, I think he said Tom Hamill, at the Chamber of Commerce almost every day. Well, I called Maynard, I said, so you and I do talk. Sometimes we shout at each other, but we talk frequently. I said, I think that's true, but I said, I think you're shortchanging yourself. I said, you need to go and start directing. I said, with that statement you made in the paper, you gave me more power than I want. Because now people say, we don't have to deal with that SOB up front. We get old Sweat to do it. Sweat, that gives me great power. I said, I really don't want that power. And I don't think it's fair to you. I said, I think you need to go and talk directly to these business leaders yourself. And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I said, I will come over there every day. You name the time. I will come over there with a list of CEOs, top leaders, with some suggested assignment that you want them to do. And I will dial the telephone for you. I'll hold it up to your ear if you're my husband. And you say, hello, Mr. CEO. This is your mayor, Maynard Jackson. I need your help. Would you chair this committee? Or would you do this for me? And I said, now, there'll be some stunned silence. And there'll probably be one or two heart attacks. But overwhelmingly, there will be this, yes, Mayor, I will do it. And I said, so I urged him, and he did. I said, Mayor, I said, why don't you do it? I said, loosen up. You can have some fun with it, too. I said, just drive up in your big limousine there and walk in unannounced. Just make, you know, just a good friend. I said, I haven't did that. Sam didn't do too much of it, but I said, I was just the style. Just do it. And walk in. Say, listen, there's Mr. So-and-so here. I was in the neighborhood. I was down at the bank making a deposit in my account. And just thought I'd speak to him. I said, you'll find it interesting. But Maynard, he never really could do that to any great extent. Did more of it finally toward in his second term, you know, after he did get some white support, you know, in his second term. And did more back then, but early on, I mean, it was one of them.
So pretty much anything he did to challenge the business community on things like affirmative action were perceived as anti-white.
By a good point.
Yeah, his feeling was that all he was trying to do was to bring blacks, give blacks the legal rights to inclusion in the politics and the economy of the city. He felt he was, before blacks were working from a subordinate position, now blacks who are in politics, they wanted to be on an equal level.
Well, I tell you one interesting, he used to, you know, he'd call me and say, Dan, come over here, can you come over and let me, I want to share something with you. And even though, you know, he used as a devil's advocate a lot, too. I remember he called me one of these, I want to show you something. He said, I've taken a look at city contracts. He said, blacks, minorities, but blacks, really have about 0.1% or 1% of the city contracts. And he said, I'm going to come up, I'm going to propose a program that will help bring that up to 0.5%. He said, and that's just like that, but as far as a black community, black entrepreneurs are so forbidden, it's a significant amount. I mean, to the black community, it's zilch. But he talked about the kind of jump into the program. I said, well, Mayor, you know what? I said, let me say something. I said, now, I was over here for a number of years and with you, and we had a lot of, I said, now, as you well know, I brought in, I recruited and brought in the first two black department here as a personnel director and the photograph director. And we made some progress there, I said, but, you know, I said, I don't remember ever having a discussion with you, any of the black business leaders, anybody else, about minority participation in the contract. You know, maybe I just got left out of discussion, but I was in a lot of them. I said, so I'm not going to feel guilty about that. I said, it just wasn't something that we were not thought about, but I said, you're not going to make me feel guilty because you didn't come jump on me back. And so, but I agreed with his joint venture concept. It caused a lot of problems, but and I still keep urging, and I made no headway. I keep trying to get the black community through probably the black academic institutions to do an in-depth study of what that produced realistically, because it's still hanging over everybody. Did it just make Herman richer? Herman's a good friend of mine on my board executive committee. Or did it give Tom Cordy a boost? And did it have any long-term impact? Did it just bring that guy from Cleveland in here to make a lot of profits and leave, and then created temporary jobs? And what happened to those people?
Interesting. On the joint venture thing, the reaction from the business community there was pretty hostile, so I can get
it. It was,
especially in the airport.
Because it was a new thing. I mean, the impression of most of the business community was, we're going to be forced to take Maynard's cronies, or city council, or some city council person's brother, to pay them off and just have a black face and do nothing.
So he resisted for a while.
I think there was a good bit of resistance.
Now, didn't Michelle also propose when that blacks get a certain percentage of the MARTA contracts?
Yeah.
And that's basically the same thing. He was suggesting joint venture before
he suggested, but he didn't. It was there was a difference in Marcel suggesting this and Maynard Jackson dictated.
Oh, Marcel never went through with it.
It was an encouragement thing, but it wasn't put in his official policy.
How about some of the other things Jackson did? How about his efforts to fire police chief Inman? Was that an issue to the business community at all?
Well, it was an issue to. It was an issue to the business community, I think, because it a lot of them proceeded just to get rid of him, and then when he put Reggie E, came in Reggie E, as his old college buddy, that was an indication, I think, a lot of concern on a lot of people that, but Inman should never have been police chief to start with. That was a serious mistake.
Mm-hmm.
When I write my book, I'm going to write all the inside stuff to this, but I'll have to wait till there's a number of funerals before I can get it. Because I remember when I went to the Atlanta Regional Commission when a lot of this was going on, and I had the $20 million high crime impact study grant from Washington, and I had the criminal justice planning responsibility, and I had two police chiefs, very opposite, two young police chiefs doing my work. And so I took them over, and then when all this started, I went over to Edmund in his office. He was just, he'd just been police chief for a little while, and when all this started, and I said, John, I don't want to meddle in your business, but I'm spending all this money doing all this stuff. I've got two young police chiefs here, and I want to offer them to you, assist you. What can we do to help you? I was flabbergasted by him, and then he's sitting there, chief's badge had ace of damn. He said, I'm not qualified to be the police chief. I don't even know what questions to ask. At least he was honest about it.
So the business community didn't particularly support him in over that issue?
No. If it had been Jenkins, still in there, and they were trying that, then there would have been.
How about things like Jackson's having appointed powers over the zoning review boards? Is that an issue at all? The creation of the zoning review board and Jackson's appointed powers?
I don't know. But I don't think that was a big issue.
Yeah. Given concerns about a black mayor, and I guess it was pretty certain that a black would be elected to 73, I was curious why there was a charter reform right then that gave the mayor more powers. It seemed to me that there was so much fear of a black mayor coming in. Why?
Well, some of us had pushed, and as a public administrator, I had pushed for reform, and part of that, my position was created, chief administrator, office of administrators, and board of all, there were some of us, me inside, Gracie Hamilton, the legislature, Jerry Horton, and then we got read out, and then some others, but Gracie Hamilton could probably shed much light on anybody, but that felt we need to move toward a stronger administrative management capability in City Hall. The old Aldermanic system just didn't do that. Mm-hmm. You had a weak mayor system. You had, in fact, strong mayors, Marshfield and Allen, so there were noises that were being made, and frankly, I was aiding and abetting that. But Grayson, the legislature was going to do something to change the form of government. Unless, so frankly, that I, as an attempt to, Allen didn't really want to have somebody, but he realized that something had to happen. So I drew up the staffing and the thing that created that,
yeah.
The staff and how it would work. And it was a compromise to head off the legislature. Richard Freeman was on that, Richard was on the Aldermanic side as part of that discussion, and Milton Ferris, I think, in an effort to keep the legislature from doing something to change the form of government.
So it had nothing to do with a black mayor coming in.
That had nothing to do. But that was a step, a compromise step, but there was still that concern that we needed to move toward a different system to clarify a lot of the problems, weaknesses in the old system. That had been in the work for a long time. It had nothing to do with the new mayor.
Also curious that 1971, Vice Mayor Jackson said the following, criticized the reorganization of the Atlanta Region Metro Planning Commission so as to, in effect, eliminate the influence of blacks on regional planning. I haven't found anything about that at all. I was curious. You were on the ARC at that time.
Well, I helped draft the bill. I was its first executive director. And Maynard and I had some interesting discussions on that subject. And Maynard viewed, I think, sincerely at that time, from his point of view, viewed it as an attempt to create some mechanism to water down black influence and, take more away from the city. That was not here. Again, you had the sort of the same people that from the legislative side who were trying to strengthen city government that was behind that effort. And that was Gracie Hamilton, Jerry Horton, Red Appleton.
Behind the ARC effort or behind the...
Behind the ARC effort. That's right. But I worked with them to help draft that bill. I remember the first meeting we had was right across the street, the old trust company building, was a number of them, to get that whole movement going. And then I didn't know I was going to end up as executive director. I was doing it, representing Mayor Allen and the chief administrative office in all these regional matters. And Gracie Hamilton and Horton, who were not anti-black, Gracie Black, were at the forefront of getting that done. So there was nothing, it might be, but Maynard, I remember Maynard sat in my office one time, right after it was announced I was going to take the job.
Yeah.
I remember Maynard came and sat down. And he was agitated. One of his statements said, "Well, Dan, I don't care. You know, y'all can do what you want to try to water down the blacks in the city, but we'll be the majority in the region eventually anyway. So you're not going to be able to overcome." So he had some emotional feelings, I think, that was the.
So it was his perception of that the problem.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to get on to urban renewal also. From what I can see, one of the goals that seems to be in urban renewal was to get the poor blacks out of the downtown area. Is that was to eliminate the slums to get the poor blacks out of the central business district? Is that one of the goals?
The urban renewal, that whole process really started before I got involved in the city. I suppose some probably had that motive, but I think my view would be to clean up the slums.
Did you see any relation to the fact that there's so much a lack of housing in the city, central city today, related to the fact that there was an effort to keep public housing out of the area and break up?
Yeah, but all the public housing is in the central city, right around the, if you look on the other side of the coin, if you look at starting back in the 30s, way before urban renewal, and then continuing after urban renewal, the city of Atlanta was the only jurisdiction trying to do anything about housing the poor. So if they had just eliminated their slums and not, on the other hand, pursued very vigorously federal funds for public housing, then I think they would have been guilty of what you're suggesting or somebody suggested might be the case. But if you look at public housing in Atlanta, I don't know where it fits in now, but I know I used to, some of my speeches used to talk about Atlanta was like the 25th, the 30th, it's come on the largest city in America at some point. But it had the sixth largest amount of public housing. So on a per capita basis, this city has done more almost than any other city with regard to housing the poor. And when I went to City Hall that was a big effort. We created the Housing Resources Committee, and I was charged with helping to push the development of the housing of, I think I got about 8,000 public housing units built. Some of them about to get torn down now.
Yeah. The honest place that the housing was being pushed towards the west side, that there was I guess the congregation of the housing was being pushed along to the west side.
Well, but that's not true. East Lake Meadows is on the east side. Capital Homes on the east side.
Nothing on the north side.
Huh?
Nothing on the north. Northeast.
Nothing on the northeast. And I suspect, well, and you know, that certainly was a political problem as well as a problem of economics of a lot of things. Just like now, you know, the housing authority can't flood Stella deal. They had to give back this money or it had gone back. Today, because HUD said you got to put it, you can't put it in Buckhead. I mean, that doesn't make sense economically or really socially, in my view.
But there was a lot of push from the blacks during this time to scatter site public housing, put it in all sections.
And in defense of me and those that were involved, in it, when Alan told me to get this thing moving, and I've got Colonel Jones from the building inspector's office assigned to me to help staff that committee. And I said, okay, Colonel, because what I had found out, there had been zoning patterns in the past. We looked at all the land, and we found these weird tracks that had been zoned, and it was obvious, you know, that probably they'd been zoned as barriers, buffers, all around. And so I said, okay, Colonel, you identify sites throughout the city. No holes barred where we can pursue public housing. And I remember I went to Allen, and it was funny. How about say this? You
let me turn it up.
Yeah. Turn it off. I mean, it will never happen, but
yeah. So I guess your feeling was, I guess from the black point of view, all the public housing is being pushed to the west side. Their feeling was that blacks moving out of the central business district and everything was being shifted to the west, and they were being, in a sense, re-ghettoized in that area. You know, that was their point of view.
Yeah. There probably was a certain, not a truth in that, but it didn't have, in my view, a lot to do with, even really just re-ghettoize. It was just a fact of economics and political life.
What about the placing of the Omni? I got somebody from the Atlanta Voice, which claims that the Omni complex was built as a buffer to keep blacks from advancing to the west side.
Yeah, of course, and no truth in that at all. It was a dream of Chuck Palmer.
Yeah.
If you ever read The Adventures of a Slumlord, he got Roosevelt into father public housing in America. And Chuck Palmer was one that got that going. He had first started out on those decks. He owned he was located in the Glenville. Mm-hmm. And I used to sit there with Chuck Palmer. I love the old guy. And in his office and looking over that site. And he was trying to get a big World's Fair there. And that was the site he owned the World's Fair on. And it just never materialized. But he saw revitalizing that area over the railroad really for a great World's Fair to leave something in place. That didn't materialize, so the concept of the World Congress Center sort of evolved out of there, and that was the site. I never heard any discussion of a buffer, and it's...
I never heard either. I mean,
there's no truth in that.
Yeah, that's the voice of the only place I heard.
Yeah, no.
Now, I did hear, in relation to the placing of the stadium, that that had been put up in a buffer, a racial buffer, or that there had been original plans by Allen for the white project in that area, and that there were protests from black leaders who wanted a black project there. And caught between the business community and the black leaders, Allen finally decided to just put the stadium in that section.
That was before I got involved, so I don't know, but it's, I've read the Fisher stories, and I've heard Allen talk about him and Mills, and Knucklehead from California, trying to get the team in here.
Baseball team.
And where they were out there on the site, and the guy said, I could get a crack of the bat on the ball from the site down.
What about the when Ivan Allen was mayor? When I spoke to him, he said something to the effect that his pro-civil rights stand helped Atlanta get federal money for various programs.
Sure, it all did. That's why I was hired by Allen as a federal bagman. And Allen was, and I recognized the need for it. Allen initially wanted me to put me in Washington to maybe go up and live. John Lindsay had set up an office in Washington out of New York. That was the first effort. As far as I could determine, I was the first federal bagman in a city hall outside of what Lindsay had done.
Yeah.
And Allen wanted me to go up. I said, no, I'm not going up. I don't want to live in Washington. I said, I can get on the Delta out here. If this is important, I think I should be located in the mayor's office here. Help you determine what our priorities are, and then we'll go after the money to address our priorities. And I said, I can get that early bird up there in the morning, come back and rally birds, and no problem there. I said, frankly, really, because Allen had been the only Southern politician to testify for the first Civil Rights Act. We had Carl Sanders, who was governor, who was a friend of Lyndon Johnson's, and ate barbecue on the Pernales with him. We had two liberal Democratic congressmen, Mackey and Weltner. And we had the civil rights leadership here in Atlanta, for God's sake. Sure. So I said, listen, Atlanta is a fair-haired city with all this going for us. I said, I could go up there to Washington, and I could drink martinis all afternoon at Duke Zebra's, and we still don't get the money. And I said, no, I didn't quit. So we agreed, and so I did that, but it was. So it was, it made a real difference.
People in Washington were willing to listen to Atlanta leaders because they were playing ball, in a sense, with them.
Exactly. And it made my job easier. I became semi-famous for all the federal money I brought in here. But I said, listen, you got a trained SEAL to go up there and got it ready. But my philosophy was get there first. I had the advantage of being here with all that behind us. And my philosophy always be there first is for the most of us. Anytime a new program came along, whether it was model cities or whether it was whatever, the first application they received was from Atlanta. I would I remember model cities, they required such a such an application. I sent two young people on a station wagon to deliver the application, took a station wagon. I took this one copy of these, and just both hands weighted it down, and flew up there to be there first, and then said, well, the other stuff is coming along. Now, Alan, I remember, you know, when the poverty program started, when it was going to be reviewed, I had just left the poverty program where I helped organize the EOA here, and going over to City Hall to do this. And so, Alan, we got a call from Sergeant Shriver. And said, you know, later on, would you come up and try to help us get some votes out of the Georgia delegation? So Mayor and I went up there, and we made rounds, and it was funny. I just like to see the boys back. I think it was great when we did it. But I think we started out with, we figured we had four votes. I think we lost one in the process making the round, but it was interesting. But we were sitting up in the gallery. We were the only mayor in America sitting there while they were the vote. That said something from Johnson and Shriver, the rest of the guys. When I went back up for the money, that was funny. And I never will forget, he was going down to talk to Maston O'Neill. We couldn't get him pulled. Maston O'Neill was a congressman from Southwest Georgia, Bainbridge, Donaldsonville, Birmingham. And Alan said, well, I'm going down there and see if I can get that guy O'Neill to talk. I said, well, good luck. And I saw O'Neill and Page come get him and go back to the courtroom. And a few minutes, I saw O'Neill go back, and the mayor comes up. He's red-faced. I mean, he just smokes coming out of his ear. I said, did you get his vote? Like saw the bitch say. He said, Mr. Mayor. He said, why don't y'all just leave us alone? He said, if you just leave us alone with our niggers and our mules down in South Georgia, we'll be happy and they'll be happy. And so he said, Mayor LaToy said, Mr. Congressman says, I don't know what you're doing with your mules, but you're sending all your niggers to Atlanta. Ill-prepared, ill-qualified, untrained, uneducated, and this is what this program is all about. And that was the end of that.
But you did get a lot of support in Washington, basically.
A lot of support.
I was also curious about the importance of racial factors in decision-making in the city. And the Allen administration, Michelle, the business community, there was a comment in 1975, which I think Mayor Jackson made, that race is the underlying force in the area's politics, no matter what the rhetoric. I'm just curious what role did
still to today, but probably from an opposite point of view.
In what sense?
I mean, the race thing, but mainly it was perceived, and truth, because you're coming from white to black. No, it's coming from black to
black. But do you think, I mean, I think Ivan Allen made a statement that almost every decision he made had a racial factor.
And in this city, that's true. This city, the thing that probably has distinguished this city more than any other city, and the thing you said more than anything else, is the racial situation because of the black leadership, the whole civil rights leadership. It came from here or through the Atlanta University system. And so, so that's been true, and it's still true to this day. I wish it weren't, we will be in utopia when we finally get to the point where that's not true, but it is true to a large extent.
I was also curious about Allen's attempt to put more blacks in the city departments in his administration. Apparently there was some complaints from blacks that while he was voicing that there was a lot of resistance from department heads on placing blacks.
There was a lot of resistance. So you still had the old line department heads, fiercely loyal to the city. I mean, the city was their life. They had been hired way back in the Depression era, many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they were the city departments. Yeah. And under the weak mayor system and the automatic system, there wasn't a lot the mayor could do except encourage the poor. And there was that great reluctance coming out of the old traditions, the old upper. There was just not a big push. That's really when Marcel came in, and Marcel and I sitting right over in the Marriott, the old Marriott one night, when I decided whether I was going to stay with him or not. I said, you know, you have my resignation, Mr. Mayor. I think you should have your own person.
So
we talked. We looked to say, okay, who are the first two that will be leaving retirement? Personnel Director Carl General Sutherland and Ray Nixon, the Public Works Director.
Under myself.
Under myself. And I was charged with finding qualified blacks, and that's another whole story.
But even at that point, I guess there was still resistance to bring the blacks.
Certainly there was resistance.
Yeah. And I guess in the sense Jackson being the first black mayor, going to really steamroll it through finally.
Well, yeah, there was some progress made under Massell. You have to give him credit because those two department heads, my replacement, which turned out to be a disaster for Jackson, Emma Darnell, we hired to replace me as the federal aid coordinator when I became the chief administrative officer, the first black mayor, professional in the mayor's office. So we brought in some black at the top level, sort of just jumping over the whole system. But and I think Massell needs to be given credit for that in history. But you know, it was not until Jackson came with his social agenda, which he had to do full speed.
I was also curious about the Atlanta School Compromise in 1972. That had apparently been worked out between the Chamber of Commerce and Lonnie King and the.
That's an area that I was not involved in those discussions.
Well, that's the Fulton County consolidation that I know you've been involved in. How much has this been opposed or supported on racial grounds?
99.8% on racial grounds, in my view. There's, you know, it makes so much sense in every other way. The only problem is race, as I see. And, my argument, when I brought that topic up again a few years ago to, you know, try to get some discussion going, it did for a while. I mean, I had hate calls for a long time, yeah. And folks were over here. And, but that's okay. But, you know, and I was immediately jumped on Marvin Arrington, well, even back then, but Marvin and some of the blacks see it as a way to water down the black vote. You know, when I was named chairman of the Charter Review Study Committee a couple of years ago, I got sucked into that. I mean, Zell Miller, at the point, didn't suck me in, but the process, it was a lost cause, but because it was perceived by some folks as an attempt to move toward consolidation rather than look at the city charter. When I'm going to write the history of that, I finally found out what was really behind it and who did it, but they never had owned up to it. But we tried, but I remember Marvin came in knee-jerk, so this is another attempt by white developers and all to water down the black vote and control the situation, which was not what it was all about.
Okay, but apparently when Jackson first came in as mayor, one of the very first suggestions was that there should be Fulton County Atlantic consolidation. You know, it seemed to be brought in particularly as part of the charge that Jackson was anti-white and therefore needed
to you know, some of us have been talking about that. I've talked about when I was in DeKalb County, and Charlie Emmerich, way back when Maynard Jackson was probably still in law school where he was, Charlie Emmerich, who I worked for there, we created, they got the old Metropolitan Planning Committee. Well, he was involved in that, even back further than that, but the MACLON, Metropolitan Council of Local Governments. And frankly, we saw it as a forerunner way back before the racial thing ever came up to do it. So that might have been the motive behind somebody, but not those of us who've been looking a long, long time at the need to as the region grows, need to make adjustments to provide realistic management of the resources.
Economically, it makes sense, sure.
Yeah. And what I've argued and with some of the blacks, particularly on the inside, that see it as a race, I said, wait a minute. I mean, the county now, I figure there's sort of a window about it, but the county now is, you know, controlled by black politics. You've got the chairman of the county commission, black control now, account, black sheriff. I said, so what's the big deal? I said, wouldn't it make sense? And I said, as a citizen of Atlanta, I plan to be here. Whether the blacks control it or who controls it. And you'd rather be part of controlling 80-mile-long city that cuts a swath right up through the region so that
so that if, you know, DeKalb County's got to go through you to get to Cobb County, Douglas County's got to go through Rockdale, et cetera. And you control the major resource, the heart of it.
Right.
Or had you rather sit back here and say, no, you're trying to do something, we'll just control the city, which is a shrinking part of the whole. Every day the clock ticks. So you're going to end up here controlling an island. And I'm going to fight to keep that island healthy, and I've done that here economically, and I will fight till the day they drag me out. But wouldn't you rather control this island where you've got all this growth potential, 400 Carter, Golden Triangle up there, all the South Fulton land now that's available for development? And there are some very narrow-minded blacks that that have political positions that feel like if you widen that, they would lose their political base. I was accused by Marvin again in that charter thing of it of being a stalking horse for Lomax to create this new county that Lomax had proven he could get elected in, so Lomax would have a mayorship and so forth, which is poppycock.
I was also curious about the Action Forum. Do you know when exactly that started?
I don't know the exact date.
60s, 1960s.
In late 60s or right at the turn of 70, somewhere right.
And what exactly does it do?
It is Bill Calloway was, I think, the father of Action Forum, Paul Austin and John Portman and some others that got it started. And it was an attempt, and I think by and large it's been good, to provide communication sort of on an equal basis between black and white leadership. And it's a sort of self-perpetuating hand-picked group, and that's always been an argument, but where it's an equal number of blacks and whites.
Right from the beginning, it was equal.
Equal number, that was set up to be that way. And it's continued that way till this day. It's a forum, is what it is. I have served as an ex officio member along with the Executive Chamber of Commerce for 10, 12, 15 years since I've been here. Because, you know, we always used to say, well, it's really, they got the forum, we got the action. And they write, we have to go in there because the Action Forum doesn't sit there and call the shots and give the direction. I've heard some people say to us in the chamber, they all know that ain't the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's, you know, out of a lot of the dialogue and it's been a good pull to get whites and blacks to agree on things, in general, if there's got to be any long-term sustained action and so forth, we that do it or the chamber does. In the business community, we are the institutional arm.
How long did the function of your time when the goal is to come up between Jackson and the business community back in 73 or 74 that the Action Forum knew was doing good during that period?
I think did a lot of good. Maynard was always suspicious of it. And I remember the first time Maynard, that I recall, came to a meeting, the Action Forum, we were meeting down in the Peachtree Center, down from under the Midnight Sun, a little room off there. And we met on Saturday morning, And Maynard was invited, so Maynard comes to the Action Forum. And he was always uptight with it, but, after he left. All of us went out, and we all, on Saturday morning, we'd park along Peachtree Center, Ivy Street back then. That had been the practice on Saturday morning, no problem. We came out that Saturday, about noon after May left. Everybody had a ticket on their car. There are some that still feel like Maynard was sending a message to the Action Forum. Others said it was just accidental and so forth. Yeah.
But it did function to bring the
It functioned. I think it probably served, it did serve a very good function of letting off steam and so forth. I can remember a lot of discussions in that Action Forum, a lot of fights. Joe Lowry was an active member, and I mean, he take on everybody in Action Forum, all the whites.
We kept the lines open.
Yeah. And I think it still does.
Yeah. I guess just one or two more questions. I was curious also about what the business community's reaction was to Jackson's second campaign in administration was there. Was there more acceptance in 1977 to be right again?
Well, there was more acceptance because it's a foregone conclusion. There was an attempt to try to find the great white hope on part of a lot of the business community who was really, I mean, up to here with Jackson at that point. There was a significant attempt to do that. And of course, Sidney Marcus came in. Sidney Marcus wasn't the hand-picked white hope of those that were looking for a great white hope. He wasn't. Sidney was a good guy, and man, I wish he were still here heading our delegation because he was very influential. But so a lot of them supported Sidney, but he wasn't really a part of the business community at all.
He wasn't part of the clique.
That's right.
Well, I guess in the same sense, myself wasn't part of the clique.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, let me see. The only thing I was otherwise curious about was whether there are any records of the CAP or the Central Electric Improvement Association earlier, anything that's a copy of that at some point. Files, records, newsletters, whatever you...
Yeah, what I'll do is just get you with my research director, and we'll share anything we got with it. You know, maybe the last time we moved from upstairs, downstairs, in the First National Building, I had got rid of a lot of stuff, and I sent whatever we had to the Historical Society. So they probably got some of the old stuff that I sent out there, and I sent it to Franklin Garrett.
They have the Central Improvement Association.
They probably have some of that in there, and we've got Jennifer Eccles, my research director, and one of the things that we do have, because I was going over recently, is got a notebook of old newsletters dating back, including the Central Line newspaper letters from the beginning of the organization. That's probably going to be your best takeoff point, because it does provide not an in-depth, but a pretty good track record of history from when it was, not when it was formed back in 1941 initially, but at some point, probably up into the 60s really, there's not.
Well, you have the Uptown Association too, I guess that was part of
During the merger, as the merger was coming in, and that's where we sort of pick up with the newsletters back then.
Well, I'd be curious to see what you have on Urban Renewal, because I'm doing some work with that. I spoke to Clarence Stone, I think he said yeah.
Yeah, and Jennifer will be glad to share whatever you got.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Okay.
Good luck.
Very helpful.